I'm with Matthew Boudway, the senior editor of Commonweal. And Matt, let's talk a little bit about the genesis of this project.
Well, we first talked about the idea a couple years ago, and it's been so long that I've almost forgotten what I was thinking when I first proposed it. And certainly the significance of the project has changed because of events since then. But I guess the idea was that it would be interesting to juxtapose essays by people who had decided, for whatever reason, to leave the church or no longer to practice the faith, with essays by people who had converted to Catholicism, usually as adults, and then to juxtapose both of those kinds of essays with essays by people who are cradle Catholics and have continued practicing the faith, a group that includes presumably most of our readers, most of our contributors. And by putting those three kinds of essays together, we thought we might tease out certain underlying issues that, well, that are easy to overlook, even for editors at a Catholic magazine.
You alluded to some of the things that have transpired in the 2 years since we first began talking about this project. So maybe it's a good way to sort of think about why does this package seem especially resonant or relevant now? Maybe you can get into the specifics of some of that.
Well, I mean, the obvious things are the scandals of this past summer. There was the Pennsylvania grand jury report. There was the news about former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. There was the Vigano testimony that tried to link McCarrick's scandal to Pope Francis. And in the wake of all of those demoralizing scandals, I think a lot of Catholics were wondering what was going on and feeling alienated from the church and wounded. But there was also, even before that, I think for at least a lot of Commonweal readers, there was a sense of alienation because they observed that in the last few years, serious Catholics in this country had thrown in their lot with Donald Trump, a brazenly wicked man who seems hell-bent on contradicting as many of the Beatitudes as he can. And that, too, was a cause of perplexity and discouragement, consternation. And so, yeah, people who read Commonweal, I think, have been feeling more alienated than usual. And yet, most of our readers remain Catholics, and we thought it might be a good time to ask the question, what is this really all about in the first place, to move to first things, as it were, and talk about what's really at the nerve of all this? Why do people continue to practice the faith in spite of everything that might impede their sense of loyalty to the church? And I think we got good responses.
Yeah, one of the things we point out in the introduction to this package is that there is a variety and complexity to the stories of why people come or leave or stay, and you kind of mentioned that. And I wonder if you want to highlight two or three of those stories to get a sense of that variety.
I'll maybe mention four, which can be broken into two pairs. Mm-hmm. There was the piece by Barbara McClay and the piece by Helene Stepinski. And these are personal pieces, one by a young woman who recently became Catholic and another by a woman who lost her faith or decided to part ways with the church because of an experience she had when she was a volunteer with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps in Alaska. And these are both very personal pieces that are about experiences of sinfulness in others and in oneself and how they relate to the grand creedal claims that the church makes and the authority that the church pretends to have. And then we also had pieces by New York Times columnist Ross Douthat and longtime Commonweal contributor Jack Miles. And these were more abstract pieces. These were pieces about the logic of Catholic ecclesiology, what it seems to require and what it seems to allow. And Jack Miles's ecclesiological thinking shifted over the years, and and that's why he left the church. And for Douthat, it's really ecclesiological considerations that make him feel as if, having become Catholic, there's really no alternative as long as he remains a Christian. This is where he'll stay. This is the church for him, because there's really no option that doesn't contradict something important to his sense of what Christianity is about.
Yeah, yeah. And just a reminder, too, to listeners, we'll be hearing from Helene Stepinski herself, as well as Ross Douthat and Dorothy Fortenberry in a little bit. Matt, we also note in the introduction that what all of our contributors agree on, if nothing else, is that the question of whether to belong to the church and believe in its claims is not a trivial one. Now, with a project like this, we're not necessarily sure what we're going to get from writers, right? And yet what comes through in each of these contributions is a sense of deep and careful consideration of the decisions made. I think we hoped for responses like this, but I guess, I don't know, was it something we necessarily expected?
Well, we didn't know exactly what we would get. I only asked people who I knew would send us something interesting. Because this project was so long in the making, we could take our time and be a little bit picky about our contributors. So we started out with a list of maybe half a dozen names of people that we thought would be good to get the project underway, and then we added names over time. Was I surprised? I was surprised by some, certainly, because there are some very personal revelations in some of the essays. And even with things that aren't necessarily personal, like the Douthat essay, for example, I think some people who have read Ross Douthat's writings about the church in the New York Times and elsewhere might be surprised to see that, you know, Ross has no intention of leaving the Catholic Church no matter what happens, and that his sense of disappointment with this pontificate has not really changed his sense of confidence in the Catholic Church or his sense of or his contentment there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think most of the essays that we that arrived were excellent, and none were bad.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think like any other collection of I don't know how many were there, 10 essays. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit uneven. Some are better than others. Some are shorter than others. But I think they're all pretty good, and they work well as a group, which is exactly what we were hoping for. They gain in significance by being next to other essays that reach very different conclusions.
Yeah, and I think we should just sort of make a note here to thank all the contributors, too, for what they did. You know, I'm hearing some things from readers and from subscribers. What are you hearing, Matt? Are you getting any responses from folks?
Most of the responses I've heard have been good ones. People were curious about the project. Not surprisingly, perhaps, the most favorable response seems to be to the most intimate and personal pieces. Mm. Those are pieces where many readers have identified with the author, have had similar experiences, and were gratified to find their own experience of Catholic life reflected in our pages. So often, you know, Common Will is dealing with public policy, church politics, mm-hmm. lofty intellectual matters, or, you know, practical matters, but not necessarily you know, the quick of the faith. And in these essays, we're reminded, again, why we're all in this together and why we persist. And we're also reminded that the stakes could not be more important, and that this is a choice that, mm-hmm. that we make to keep our baptismal vows, to go to Mass every Sunday or some Sundays. It's not something that we have to do. And if we're only doing it by force of habit, then we're not doing it the way the church wants us to, the way Christ invites us to.
Thanks, Matt, and thanks for shepherding this project through.
Thank you. Ross Douthat is a New York Times columnist and the author of several books, including To Change the Church, Pope Francis, and the Future of Catholicism. He has an essay in the December 1st issue of Commonweal about why, despite his disagreements with the current pope, he has no plans to leave the Catholic Church. Ross, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
In your essay, you present an elaborate argument against two alternatives that seem to be available to conservative Catholics unhappy with the direction of the church under Pope Francis. In fact, the argument's too elaborate for us to cover in detail, but maybe you could say a few words about what those alternative options are and why you reject them.
Sure, I'll try and be non-elaborate. Basically, it seems to me that if you are a conservative Catholic or traditionalist Catholic, if you prefer, troubled by the direction of the Francis pontificate, some of the, you know, documents and controversies surrounding divorce and remarriage and so on, and you are not, you know, inspired by these doubts to give up your basic Catholic perspective entirely and go become a hard shell Baptist somewhere in the Appalachians, then you really have two options. One option is to consider joining the Orthodox Church, or one of the Orthodox churches, I suppose I should say. And the other option is the kind of internal exile that it, at least that's the term that I use to describe the Society of St. Pius X, which is a group that has managed to continue to profess loyalty to the Pope while not actually being governed by the papacy. So those seem like the two options. And without going into too much detail, I guess my view of the Orthodox option is in part that it would be a little peculiar for someone perturbed by the possibility of a change in Catholic teaching on marriage and divorce to join a church where that teaching was already made, give or take, 1,000 years ago, right? You're not actually going to find the sort of solution to the particular dilemma that has vexed a lot of conservative Catholics in the Orthodox Church. But then the larger point I make is that, at least in my own thinking, you know, you could talk yourself into the idea that Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism are in fact roughly equal in their claims, you know, that they both have legitimate claims to represent the church going back to the apostles. But even if you get to that point as a Catholic in the United States or Western Europe, or indeed most of the world in which Catholicism exists, it still seems to me to be the case that if Orthodoxy and Rome were in some way co-equal, unless you were actually a Russian or, you know, someone sort of born into a culture where the Orthodox patriarchates have authority, it still doesn't make sense to jump to swim the Bosporus. The Catholic Church, even if you end up thinking that its claims are more limited, would still be the church for the Western world. You know, would still be the Pope would still be the Patriarch of Rome and all the rest. And so I completely understand the sort of very personal reasons why people end up converting to Orthodoxy. I understand, you know, people who have liturgical reasons for converting to Orthodoxy. I'm just sort of, I've never been able to get my mind around the idea that having decided that Rome and Eastern Orthodoxy were, having decided that Rome's claims on behalf of itself were too strong and that Eastern Orthodoxy's claims were equal, that someone living in the United States would still think that it made sense to join a church that even under that theory is for a different part of Christendom. That was not a non-elaborate answer, and I apologize.
Well, what about the other option then? Joining a traditionalist Catholic group that breaks away in some way, a quasi-schismatic group?
Well, I think they would say that they aren't schismatic, right? That's the whole theory and idea of the SSPX in their own perspective, is that they aren't schismatic. And in fact, I think you can make some arguments about some of the moves that Rome has made over the last 10 or 15 years that would partially validate that claim. At the same time, you know, it doesn't seem to me that in making that kind of move, I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, you might go to a SSPX chapel now and again, for sort of liturgical reasons or something like that. But to move yourself into a situation where you are effectively under the authority of whichever bishop happens to be running the SSPX, it's to exchange the scripturally attested, historically rooted authority of the Bishop of Rome for a form of authority that doesn't have any kind of historical attestation, that doesn't have the promises of Jesus behind it. And you have to assume in making that move, ultimately, you're basically saying, I know what tradition says. Rome has broken with Catholic tradition, therefore I'm staying with tradition. But even if you think that Rome has broken with tradition, tradition is not self-interpreting. If it were self-interpreting, you wouldn't have the sort of mini schisms that beset the traditionalist world, right? So you still ultimately are putting your trust in some kind of authority. And, you know, however many doubts a conservative Catholic might have about sort of the state of the papacy or the state of papal teaching and so on, it still doesn't seem like the move to sort of really put yourself under the authority of Bishop Fillet, as lovely and holy a man as he may be, makes all that much logical sense.
You have more than one disagreement with Pope Francis, but I think it's fair to say your main criticism has to do with his suggestion that some divorced and remarried Catholics who don't have an annulment should be able to receive communion anyway. In your essay, you recommend that Catholics on your side of that controversy combine, quote, disputation and submission until time and providence either vindicate your position or prove through a slow accretion of evidence that you were simply wrong, close quote. I wonder what you think it would look like for time to prove you wrong.
I wonder that myself. I mean, I think that at the very least, it would mean, well, let me put it this way. And this, again, relates to why I'm doubtful about the theory and practice of the Society of St. Pius X. You know, to join the Catholic Church is to join an institution that claims to be the Church of Jesus Christ in a pretty obvious and straightforward way, that Jesus picked Peter and built his church upon that rock, and the papacy is still that rock today, and all the rest of it. Now, that could be wrong, but that's the theory. And the more that conservative disputation with particular papal decisions and papal rulings ends up seeming like a kind of irrelevant minor sect within the larger global church, the more doubtful one should be on any kind of Catholic terms that that disputation, that disagreement is correct, I guess. So I don't have sort of a, like, you know, here's the year 2077 when conservative critics of Amoris Laetitia will have to admit that they were wrong. But I think that defenders of Pope Francis and allies of Pope Francis who argue that, you know, this teaching will be gradually accepted by the church and disagreement will fade to the margins and so on, I don't think that argument is dispositive now, but over a, let's, you know, over a multi-decade and multi-century time horizon, it might be dispositive. I'm skeptical of the sort of the side of Catholic traditionalism that basically wants to claim that there's a kind of church in exile. And if there is such a church in exile, I'm skeptical that God would allow it to remain in exile for 500 or 600 years, let's say. At that point, you're into the territory of effectively Protestant views of the church, I think. And then saying that that's a Catholic view sort of becomes untenable. So, you know, Pope Francis's line about, you know, time is greater than space and all the rest. If you want to, you could pull that line, I think, to make the case that the clearer a change becomes and the longer it is taught without crisis or rupture, the more people who consider this, themselves Catholic in a consistent way would need to accept it.
Right. I mean, one way of taking your argument is that it's sort of an empirical one, a prediction that you could test. If the church makes exceptions to its rule barring remarried Catholics from receiving communion, then every remarried Catholic and maybe even everyone in a state of mortal sin will feel free to receive communion. And then the whole sacramental discipline will break down. That's sort of your prediction. Your argument could also be read to mean that no matter what the consequences, it's wrong to depart in any way from the discipline. And in that case, time won't tell us one way or the other, will it? I mean, you'll be right on principle or wrong on principle, but not because any information comes in.
Well, but right. But if I'm right on principle, if it's wrong to make this departure, and again, if this, I mean, I think part of the difficulty here is that the Holy Father has very deliberately sort of chosen ambiguity in how he has made changes, both in this area and in other, I think, somewhat less important, but still meaningful areas as well. And so as long as you have this kind of ambiguity, there is room for a lot of disagreement and conflict and so on that doesn't sort of necessarily call into question broader Catholic claims. But then the question in turn becomes, well, how long can the church teach ambiguously on something really important before you start to call into question broader Catholic claims? So in the end, I think you're right that the conservative could continue thinking that he or she is right, no matter what happens. But in thinking that, at a certain point, they'll have to change their view about the papacy and the church itself, right? I think that's the key thing, that either at a certain point, either you have to say, I was wrong and the church was right, or I was wrong and Pope Francis was right, or you have to say, I continue to be right, but the view of papal authority and the continuity of church teaching that I held under John Paul II has not been vindicated by events. That seems to be those are the two options. And again, I don't think either option makes a clear case for leaving Catholicism.
Right. I wonder if your disappointment about this pontificate has changed the way you feel about your conversion. I think most of our readers will find your essay logically compelling, but I also think a lot of them will come away from it with the impression that you remain in the church because you feel stuck, because there's nowhere else to go. Do you feel trapped, or do you just feel liberated from the anxiety of having to constantly revisit your original decision to become Catholic?
Stuck. I don't feel
you
stuck.
Stuck, I guess. But not in this.
No, that's a good word. I think that's a reasonable reading of the essay. I mean, I think the essay is not its weakness, but its limit is that it's trying to think about this in terms of, you know, sort of an intellectual problem and intellectual consistency and all of these things. When in fact, to the extent that it's about me and my conversion and my experience of Catholic faith, there's a lot more to my experience of Catholicism, believe it or not, than what I write about the papacy and what I write, the arguments that I get into with journalists and theologians about Amoris Laetitia. In that sense, I don't think I'm stuck. I'm very happy to be Catholic. I think I'm in the right place and more people should be in this place. But in terms of the intellectual issue, the intellectual questions, there is a sense of like, yeah, there isn't anywhere else to go. And maybe there are more contradictions here than I had thought or hoped at one point. We'll find out.
Right. So are you as happy now as you were before some of the perplexities of this pontificate perturbed your intellectual satisfaction with the church as a system?
I mean, honestly, the most, you know, the primary way that I've experienced Catholicism over the last 5 or 6 years is as a father of children, as someone I've been struggling with some chronic illness. Things like that have loomed a lot larger in my everyday experience of religious faith and of Catholicism. And so I don't, when I think about my own happiness or lack thereof, I would say there was about a 3-month period when it was around the first Synod on the Family, when I was genuinely perturbed in sort of my own psyche about this stuff. But at this point, you know, I'm unhappy with the state of the church on like 16 different levels, as are many people, or, you know, you wouldn't be running fine essays in this issue about people leaving the church as well as coming and staying. And obviously everything that's happened with sex abuse, really since I wrote this piece for you in draft form, has been perturbing, disquieting, horrifying, depressing, all of those kind of words. So I'm less happy with the state of the church by far than I was at the end of the Benedict pontificate for all kinds of reasons, Amoris Laetitia among them. But I would say I'm just as happy being a Catholic as I was then.
Thank you again for joining us, Ross.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for letting me ramble about ecclesiology in your pages.
Our pleasure.
I'm here with Helene Stepinski, who is a contributor to our special December 1st issue, Why We Came, Why We Left, Why We Stayed. Helene is the author of 3 books, most recently A Murder in Matera, and a frequent contributor to the New York Times. Helene, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Dominic.
So you wrote a very moving account, a very personal account about your decision to leave the Catholic Church, and you detail it with kind of agonizing detail. But I want to maybe give listeners a sense of not only what happened to you, what you experienced once you got to Alaska, but how you grew up and what your relationship to the Catholic Church was. So maybe a little bit of your background would be helpful.
Absolutely. I grew up in Jersey City, New Jersey, which was a working class community. My dad was a checker at a warehouse. My mom worked at the DMV. No one I had ever known or grown up with had ever been a writer. So it was a working class situation. I had bus driver uncles and, you know, waitress aunts. And everybody went to church, everybody. And you were defined by your parish. So where you lived generally, you know, had a few parishes in it. And depending on your ethnicity, usually, you went to a certain parish. I went to Our Lady of Częstochowa, which was always very difficult to spell. We had to learn to spell that in kindergarten. I went to Mass every Sunday, either 9 o'clock Mass, which was the children's Mass, or noon, which was when we'd rather go because it was later in the day. And my father collected the money during Mass. My mother was very involved with the parish and the PTA. I was taught by nuns most of my upbringing. I had a lot of good nuns, but several very bad nuns who I've written about in the past in other situations. We had one nun in fourth grade who told us that the Russians had a button that they could push and we would all be obliterated, you know, one of those nuns. Anyway, but for the most part, they were terrific teachers and great women. And I love the nuns. I still love the nuns. So that was my upbringing. You know, I continued to go to Mass weekly until I was well into my teen years. I went to a Catholic all-girls high school, wore a uniform my whole life, my whole young life. It probably wasn't until I went to college, really, that I started to question the Catholic Church. I went to NYU. It was the first time I was ever exposed to people from different faiths. So it was kind of mind-blowing. I had a class on world religions, really great class, with a guy named James Carse. I think he's still out there. So I just, you know, I started to question things. And my biggest issues were the stances that the church took, you know, on birth control and women in the church and things like that. So I, you know, I had problems with it. And I kind of slowed down and going to church and things like that. But, you know, I was working as a reporter. I studied journalism at NYU, went on to become a reporter at my hometown paper. And I was covering all kinds of social justice issues. It was frustrating. I mean, I worked there for 3 years. I wrote a column for them. And I tackled everything from, you know, AIDS to toxic waste to the mafia to homelessness to you name it. I covered it because Jersey City was a pretty rough place to grow up. I actually wrote a book about Jersey City. That was my first book, Five Finger Discount. But so I was working there and trying to get some stuff done, you know, trying to help people. And it just didn't seem to be working. It's, you know, I would get nasty phone calls from people. Once in a while, something positive would happen from a story that I wrote. But I just felt really frustrated. And so I was going to join the Peace Corps, I think. And I checked it out. I was like, I don't know. Do I want to go to a far-flung place like Africa or something? I don't know how to build bridges. I don't know, you know, what would I do, you know? And I had a roommate at the time and a good friend named Sarah, Sarah Eckel, who's also a writer, who had gone to Fordham in the Bronx. And she was connected with the Jesuit community and knew about the JVC. And when I had started talking about the Peace Corps, she said, well, what about the JVC? And I had never even heard of it. So, you know, I looked into it and it really seemed to fit the bill for me. You know, I had been raised Catholic. I still sort of considered myself Catholic. The JVC seemed pretty progressive. I always loved the Jesuits because they were smart thinking Catholics and questioned things. So I sort of threw it out there and said, okay, well, let's see. So I applied and they had a great position in Nome, Alaska at a radio station.
Now, did you ever think that it was going to be Alaska in particular that you're going to head to, or how did that specific decision come about?
How did Alaska come about? You know, I just realized last night Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was on TV, and I think I applied to Alaska because I loved Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer as a kid. I remember Rudolph like gliding away on the ice floe. You know what I mean? And the Aurora Borealis in the background. And it was a childhood dream for me to do that, you know? And so I think there was some just sort of like thing in my head, in the back of my head, that I wanted to go to Alaska one day, you know, the North Pole, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to get away. You know, I wanted to get out of the New York area. I had been here my whole life and I wanted an adventure. I wanted to help people, but I wanted to just be in a new environment, you know? And that was basically Nome, Alaska, which is where I wound up, was as far as you could go without leaving the continent for the JVC. So
you arrive at Nome and your assignment is to work on the little radio station that's in Nome, Alaska. And what was the name of the station and how did that all sort of unfold?
Sure. It was called KNOM. We used to joke it was monk spelled backwards. You know, it was run by lay people, but it had been founded by a priest named Jim Poole, who was like a celebrity up there. He wasn't there anymore. He had moved to the lower 48, but he had founded the station. And we played regular music, but we also, they ran prayers on the air. They did a nightly rosary. They ran sermons by Poole, you know, inspirational spots by Poole, things like that. And it was real service to the community in a lot of ways. I mean, because, you know, it's hard to get around up there in the winter. And this was before the dawn of cell phones, you know, and people couldn't really get in touch with each other. So the radio was this conduit of information. So say you were on the road, you know, and there was a snowstorm coming. This actually happened to me. I was driving out to this hot spring in October, and my friends who were running the station said, Helene, at milepost 53, large snowdrifts, turn back, you know, while I was listening to the radio. So it would actually have a purpose, the radio. I mean, it wasn't just for listening to pop music, you know, it was actually a method of communication for up there. It's hard to get from point A to point B up there once it snows. And like I said, there were no cell phones unless you had walkie-talkies. I guess there was no way to get in touch with people. So we did provide an important service up there. But, you know, the spiritual hole in my life was not really being filled, I have to say. I mean, it was filled through like nature and going out onto the tundra and things like that, and dog sledding and being alone in the middle of nowhere. You know, I kind of found myself in a lot of ways that way. But the church there just was not very engaging, and the pastor was not a very charismatic guy, and it was not a great place as far as the Catholic Church goes. I felt another distance from it, really.
Mm-hmm. Yet being there, as you said, you sort of did manage to, I think, find certain satisfactions in some of the other encounters that you had, and you have a very sort of a vivid recounting of your encounter with a young woman in one of the smaller villages outside of Nome. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah. What we would do is I would travel to all the Eskimo villages to write stories, because I was the news director. So I really traveled around a lot. And that was really the most wonderful part of the job, because you got to meet these people in these remote places. So one time it was towards the end of my stint there. It was in May, I think. I went to a place called St. Mary's. It was an Eskimo village, and Reverend Poole had started the station there like in the late 50s. It wasn't even a radio station yet. It was like a PA system that he had set up. And so it was this sort of sacred place for KNOM, you know? And so I went there to cover this alcohol referendum story. Basically the villagers there were voting on whether or not to have alcohol anymore, because alcohol is a real problem up there. So I'm there covering that. And while I'm there, the Black Pope, who is basically the leader of all Jesuits worldwide, flies in on a private jet. Okay. I don't know if he flew in all the way from Rome on the private jet, or if he stopped in Anchorage and hopped on a jet. I don't know, but he was there. And it was sort of a shocker. It's like, what's this guy doing here? And why weren't we notified? You know, we're with the JVC. We're in Northwest Alaska. The head of all Jesuits is here. You're like, why didn't anybody tell me? You know, so of course I've got my Marantz, you know, my tape recorder, and I'm ready to go. And I'm like, can I do an interview with this guy? And the Jesuits there, who were actually really wonderful. I love the Jesuits in St. Mary's. They were great guys. Father Chuck, terrific man. They told me, no, you can't talk to him. He's meeting privately with the elders. But you can come to dinner. We're having a big dinner celebration for him. So I did. And I recorded some stuff there. And they had a mass, a big mass that he held. And I went to the mass and I recorded some sound from that. And I did a piece about him coming. But again, wasn't allowed to talk to him. So so years later, you know, I go back to New York and I go back to the church. Eventually, I wind up baptizing my children in the Catholic Church. I'm in Brooklyn. And so I'm on board again. And then a story breaks that Reverend Poole, Jim Poole, had been molesting Eskimo girls for decades.
Helene, what year would this have been now?
I'm trying to remember what year it broke. Paulina, my daughter, was a year old, so that was
2004, I guess?
2004, yes. Our daughter's the same age, so you know. She was a year old, so I had given it the old college try. I was back at church, and then the story breaks.
And how did you hear about it?
Actually, one of the great things about the JVC and about being in Nome was the people that I became friends with who were also in the JVC. Every one of them is just a wonderful person, and I'm still great friends with them until now. And we kind of kept in touch with each other, you know, very far away from each other in some cases. One's still in Alaska, a couple are still in Alaska, people in Seattle, Portland, you know, all over the country. And one of my friends said, did you see the story about Poole? I guess it was email, you know. And sent me a link or whatever. And there was all this chatter about it on the JVC. I guess, I don't know what you would call it.
the sort of the network that was out there.
Yeah, there was like a room, a chat room that a lot of the JVC people were on. And I didn't really go to that room much, but I did have all these friends. And so they alerted me to it and everybody was kind of in shock. Some of my friends from there had gone back to the church. Some were still estranged from the church, but that sort of was a bomb, a real bomb. And people just, it just blew everybody out of the water.
So. What were some of the details that were emerging, Helene?
It's so awful. You know, I don't even like to think about it, but some of the things were he had raped a girl while she was in the hospital. He was having an affair with a mother and then raped the daughter at the same time. You know, just crazy stuff. Masturbating in front of a bunch of kids when his mother walked in. His mother's name was Luella, and she had been the first KNOM volunteer. And our house that we lived in, the house at KNOM, was named after her, Luella. And when you hear something like that, I'm still getting chills about it. It makes me get upset. You know, this community that you're a part of, all these little details about this place that you lived in is now completely tainted. And it was just, we didn't, none of us have recovered, I have to say. You know, I thought leaving the church would help me recover, but in reality, it hasn't, you know, because I still read all the stuff that's going on in the Catholic Church and I'm still just as mad. And I thought if I walked away, I could sort of cut off some of that anger, but that hasn't worked so well, which is why I wrote this essay, I think. I'm just sort of trying to work through it, you know, and find some catharsis because Poole died this past spring. And one of my dreams was to go and visit him. He was up in Washington State and he was, you know, he was supposed to be under lock and key at some home, but I'm sure, you know, who knows what the situation was. But he was allowed to wander around for years, even after they knew what he was doing. One of my dreams was to go up there and knock on his door and just punch him, you know, because I was so angry and still am angry. And so are the other people, you know, that I'm still in touch with. A lot of them, like I said, have left the church. So,
Helene, you mentioned something in your piece, too, about the fact that a number of the volunteers at the radio station continued almost to sort of work on Poole's behalf, even after all of this was going on, in terms of having to, you know, send out recordings of his messages or homilies. That occurred as well, right?
Oh, yes. I forgot, but that's a pretty major point. While we were there and didn't know about what he was doing and he was gone, they continued to play his sermons and his prayers on the air. And not only that, but we had a signature machine at the station that we used to sign letters for fundraising with his name on it. It was, and so the diocese knew what he was doing at this point. They had known for a long time. And so we're up there and we're sending his voice and his name into the public. And, you know, I felt like I was part of this terrible conspiracy. You know, in the essay, I say, you know, it felt like the church should be brought up on racketeering charges. You know, they knew this was wrong and they're not telling us what's going on, first of all, which is normal, right? But they're letting us send his sermons out there so that the girls that he abused have to hear his voice on the radio. And I'm pushing the button on those sermons.
Right. And you know, you mentioned the fact, too, that this radio station really was a mode of communication, if not the only mode of communication. So it was almost unavoidable, I would imagine.
It played everywhere. You went into a restaurant, it was on in the background. You go to a store, it's on in the background. Everybody's house had it on. If you're in your car, that's the only thing you can listen to. You know, it was everywhere. So, yeah, there was no escaping his voice. So it just still gives me chills thinking about it.
Sure. So, Helene, your piece appeared on our website mid-November. And I'm wondering if you've gotten any reaction to it. Have you heard from people that you were acquainted with in Alaska or other members of the JV community or other folks?
Yeah, I got an incredible reaction to it, actually. People that I served with in Alaska wrote to me, fellow Catholics who are pretty upset about what's been happening in the church, got in touch with me. I've gotten lots of emails, lots of notes from people. Someone from Alaska sent me a message that they had sent to the JVC on behalf of a bunch of women who worked for the JVC, asking them to reach out to them and to try and heal the community. And they haven't heard back from them. You know, and I'm still angry at the JVC as well, because they pulled out of Nome the year after we left. And I'm pretty sure it was because of Poole, because this was all sort of breaking at the time. But they never said anything to us about it. We were worried that we were one of the reasons they were pulling out of Nome because we were sort of considered the bad JVs. We used to drink in the local saloons and things like that. So we were worried that we had damaged the JVC's reputation and we were part of the reason. So for years, we're walking around guilty thinking we killed the JVC in Nome when in fact, you know, this stuff was going on with pool and they knew full well about it. And I still want to write a letter, my own personal letter to the JVC and say, you know, you really blew it, guys, you know, and you continue to blow it. You know, you're not out there doing any outreach for us. We are really scarred and no one has done anything.
Lynn, do you have any sense or belief that you might somehow find yourself one day returning to the church?
I can't imagine it. I'm so angry and I'm 53 at this point. So when is it going to happen? You know, maybe in 20 years, I don't know if they cleaned up their act, but I don't know if it's possible at this point. I just think, the people on the ground are great people. You know what I mean? If I do go to church, you know, the people who are at church and generally the priests are good people. The nuns are terrific. You know, the deacons, people like that, the foot soldiers, you know, but I just feel like the hierarchy is so tainted and so corrupt and so evil in a lot of ways. And, you know, I compared it to the mafia. You know, I said when I was covering the mafia in New Jersey, my first job, they never pretended to be anything else, but the Catholic Church, you know, has been preaching to us about sin and forgiveness for years and years, and they're really not on board, you know, and I can't put my money in those baskets so that they can defend these priests. I can't, you know, I just can't be a part of it. It's too toxic for me. And I mean, I hope there is some closure for me. I really do, but I don't really see it. I mean, do you? I don't know. Sad to say. So,
Helene, thank you for taking the time to talk today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm here with Dorothy Fordenberry, a playwright and screenwriter who is currently in her third season as a writer and producer on Hulu's award-winning adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale. Dorothy also contributed a piece to our collection in our December 1st issue, Why We Came, Why We Left, Why We Stayed. And Dorothy's was titled Why I Stay. Dorothy, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm really eager to talk to you because I was really taken with your piece, and particularly with the central image you use, go big or go home. What do you have in mind when you look at your decision to remain in the church through this idea, through this image?
Yeah, I think for me, the largeness of the church is one of its most important qualities. And I think the idea of being part of a body of, you know, a billion people is both terrifying, but also really inspirational for me. And I think my decision to stay in the church feels like a commitment to a ton of people. It feels like a commitment to a giant institution. And I think the largeness of the church, both in sheer scope and size in terms of buildings and people and, you know, wealth and, you know, historical heft, but also largeness in terms of what I think the church asks of us. I think that's partly why I started with the idea of transubstantiation. It's why I think the church is a large commitment. It's a large body and it's a big ask. And I think for me, as someone who's trying to figure out her relationship to religion, I get something out of the sheer magnitude of it. A religious practice that was easier and smaller and more tailor-made to me and more sort of handcrafted, small batch, artisanal religion, I think would be a lot of times more pleasurable, but I think ultimately less meaningful to me.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of a line from your piece that stuck out. And you said, you know, there are things I get out of the church that I don't get anywhere else. And you've kind of touched on a couple of these things. But I'm also curious as to how and when did you start to realize this? I know, and not to reveal too much about myself because I want to keep the focus on you, but I know that I've gone through this kind of thing as well, sort of stopping in at these sort of little maybe storefront churches or these artisanal kinds of places that the way you just referred to it, but kind of coming back around. How did this sort of, I guess, unfold across your adulthood, I suppose?
Sure. I mean, I grew up in the church. I'm cradle Catholic, you know, baptized, first communion. the first time I really remember wrestling with this was for confirmation. And I was in eighth grade, and I remember my mom didn't invite anybody and kept it really low key because I think she felt unsure up until the last minute if I was going to go through with it. And I was unsure up until the last minute if I was going to go through with it. And she didn't want, you know, the pressure of like, oh, your aunt and uncle and blah, 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 like feeling like I had to. So she could tell I was not sure. And I think that was the first time I really wasn't, I was on the edge. And I remember the priest at my church then was Father Brendan. And I talked to Father Brendan and he was great. And we had a great conversation. And I think often that like if Father Brendan had just been like lame or, you know, hadn't been at work that day and I had gotten somebody else, my whole life might be really different because he really heard what I was saying. He really took my concerns seriously. He responded as someone who believed that the church could change and grow and that it would. And that was really important for me to hear. So I got confirmed, but I was not particularly observant or practicing in high school. If anything, I went to a Quaker high school. And I think that's a huge part of actually why I am still Catholic, because it was a chance to be a part of a totally different religious practice. And for me, for who I was in high school, it was a great fit. It was really, you know, Quaker meeting was so different. You know, it's the opposite of a big liturgical service. You know, the whole orientation of Quakerism is just really, really sort of 180. And it was wonderful for me to be a part of it. And it kept me thinking about spirituality. It kept me thinking about looking at other people and trying to see God in them, but in a really different way. So I think when I went off to college, I was kind of like, well, I'll do something, but I don't know what. And, you know, went to the church that was near my dorm. That was sort of a mainline Protestant church, went to some Episcopalian churches. And through college, found myself coming back to the Catholic church on campus. I don't even totally know how, but I kept going. And I went to college in Boston, and this was around 2000. So I ended up being right in the middle of watching a church wrestle with, you know, all of the abuse scandal, you know, information that came out then. And again, you know, luck of the draw, there happened to be the priests at my parish were incredibly open and humble and brutally honest about what was coming out and how horrible it was. And I think, again, if I had been somewhere where the vibe had been different and people hadn't been so great, I think I would have said, like, this is garbage and walked away. But I watched that community wrestle with it and in a weird way came away kind of impressed with how they were trying to handle something so horrible. Then after college, I spent a year in Haiti. And that, I think, was also just a formative year in terms of me sort of getting over myself, which I think is a lot of what it's something that I get out of the church that I don't get other places. I think the devaluing of myself as an individual and the notion that I'm part of this big, messy collection of humans definitely is something that was hammered home. I saw so many sort of good intentions go awry. I really just felt like I was on the ground watching. Oh my gosh. I mean, just people showed up every week, very eager to help. And boy, you know, it was more complicated than that. So I think I came out of that year really appreciative of things that positioned me in an equal relationship with other people and not kind of as a like, do, you know, here I am to help. I'm the rescuer. And that's something that I get out of church. You know, when I'm sitting next to people in church, you know, all the stuff that I like to think is special and charming about myself is not relevant. And that's rare. There aren't a lot of spaces where I feel like you get to just be a person next to another person. And it doesn't matter, you know, how educated you are. It doesn't matter how wealthy you are. It doesn't matter how fancy your shoes are. You're just kind of existing in parallel humanity.
Yeah. You know, Dorothy, you speak about some of these sort of positive shaping experiences and I guess realizations or understandings. And then in your piece, you come around to talking about the alienation you began to feel along around 2012 when the Leadership Conference of Women Religious was being investigated. And then there was this, the Fortnight for Freedom was all, you know, big thing and being promoted. Talk about that a little.
Oh, that was such a hard time. Yeah, that was probably the loneliest I've ever felt in the church. You know, I just had my first daughter then. I was a, you know, young mom, and I felt so not seen and not met, sort of where I was. Like, I really felt like I was like, look, I'm trying, you guys. Like, I'm showing up, and it is not easy to make it to church, you know, with an infant whose schedule is all over the place, and I'm exhausted, and I'm working, and sort of I'm hauling myself here, and I'm open to a conversation about what does it mean to be, you know, a woman in the church right now. And I felt like I was met with such condescension and judgment, and, you know, I really didn't feel like the realities of my life were seen or appreciated. And it was also sort of that vibe of like, well, you know, if you end up leaving, it's fine. We'll probably have a better church without you anyway. That sort of smaller, purer, you know, let's get rid of.
Pruning the branches, yeah.
Yes. And I felt like I was being pruned, and I really resented it. And yeah, it was really hard. And I stayed away for months. And, you know, I emailed with priests that I knew, and I emailed with, there was a sort of religious director at the parish I was going to at the time. And she, you know, we emailed, I went and saw her, we talked. Like, there were people who I felt were listening and got it, but there were also people who weren't. And it was really hard. And yeah, I think that's another sort of, you know, roads diverging in a wood moment where I could definitely see a life for myself where I would have stepped away, or I would have found something else. Cause I really felt, you know, as an individual, and then also just for women in general, I just felt like, look, we are keeping your whole thing afloat. Like, we are doing all of this work. We are serving on committees, and we are, you know, making the snacks, and we are, you know, teaching CCD, and we are just, you know, this labor force. And to be dismissed and to be told, you know, how to think and feel just really, really got on my nerves.
Yeah. And where are you with that today, if I might ask?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm still here. I'm still in the church. I do feel like the conversation, I mean, some practical things have changed. The investigation into women religious has stopped. You know, I feel like the conversation, just in terms of the issues that I feel like, you know, the bishops are jumping up and down about right now, for a number of reasons, there's just less focus on religious freedom, sort of, you know, as it relates to birth control prescriptions and more in other ways. So it's, you know, it just feels like it's, those things are a little more back burner. You know, I don't have to confront them as directly. I think also, in some ways, for me, in this particular moment, you know, in this sort of odd political time that we're in, I really have found the church to be better at handling it than other groups and other people. And, you know, like, I went to an interfaith prayer service late November 2016 at Dolores Mission, and that felt like exactly where I wanted to be, you know, in that idea of home. It felt like, you know, it's a tiny little church, and it was pouring outside, and we were all, you know, 200 people were crammed in together, singing and praying and basically saying, like, we've got each other's backs. And that was one of the most profound and moving sort of things I've ever been a part of. So that mattered to me. And I brought my daughter, and I brought my oldest daughter, and I just sort of said to her, like, this is what we do. You know, this is where we go when things are hard. This is where we find community, and this is where we find meaning.
You mentioned bringing your daughter along to this, and I think I want to get back to something that also really came through in your essay. A big part of it centers around parenting and family. And I know in the past you've spoken about what it means to try to raise children Catholic, to say nothing of simply raising children at this point in history. But are there specific things you try to do or I guess try not to? I mean, something that comes through in your piece is an awareness of the inevitable messiness of things. And you've already touched on this a little bit in this talk, you know, but this idea that there's an impossibility kind of not having a clear-cut answer or solution to every challenge or question. I mean, I love the opening to your piece where you really jump right in with your child and transubstantiation. I mean, how do you sort of live day to day in the family like this?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge. I mean, I think what I try to do is create the space for them to be able to say that's crazy, and for me to be able to say, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, it's really, whew, yeah, sure is. You know, we're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep going. But yeah, these stories are nuts. It's nuts to be dead and to come back to life. And it's, you know, nuts that we can eat a person. And, you know, I'm going to let the sort of lunacy of that exist and acknowledge it, and then try to explain, you know, why I find it meaningful, but also not try to shape their responses. I, you know, my oldest kid is, I think by nature, pretty skeptical just of anything and everything. Like, she's very sort of facts oriented. So at school, if they do something with like ghosts for Halloween, like she'll come home and she'll be like, what's up with ghosts? Like, are ghosts real? Are ghosts not real? Like, she wants to know. It's not, she doesn't sort of have fun being like, ooh, maybe ghosts. So I think religious practice is a challenge for her, because I think she wants these sort of black and white, clear cut, like, you know, what is it? Where is it? Where's the evidence? And I think I try to just allow that to be how she responds, explain how I respond. You know, when my daughters were baptized, there was a prayer that I said for both of them. And it was that, you know, I hope that they continue to find the church a place that they can be themselves. And that's a prayer for them, but that's also a prayer for the church. You know, I want the church to be a place where whoever they are, they feel like they can be comfortable and accepted and loved. And that's a prayer. Like, that's, I don't know that that will happen. I can't know that any life that they live will make them feel that way. All I can hope is that the church, you know, grow in its love and acceptance to be able to hold them within it. But I don't know. I don't know that it will. And I am very clear-eyed about the fact that they may grow up to look at the church and be like, what is this? I can't do this. And I will say, I get it. I love you. You know, like, you're going until you're 18, because that's, you know, what we're doing. But the second you turn 19, you don't ever have to step foot in again. And I will respect and appreciate, you know, whatever choice you make.
Dorothy's essay, Why I Stay, appeared in the December 1st issue, which featured our special package, Why We Came, Why We Left, Why We Stayed. Dorothy, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.